Okay, hello and welcome to Beyond Reproach. This is Tux Lerzel.
And Stephanie Domingo.
I am coming to you from Detroit, Michigan, where I record on land belonging to the Ottawa, Potawatomi, Wyandot, and Ojibwe nations.
And I am coming to you from Medellin, Colombia, where I'm recording on land belonging to the Karina peoples.
Love that. And these are some of many nations out here in the world still very much doing their thing. And we would like to acknowledge that.
Yes. As Dev said, snaps to them.
Yes. So for those of you who may have forgotten since last week, Beyond Reproach is the show about scandals and scandalousness in American politics and government. And as per usual, we be drinking and we be swearing.
Yes, we are back on our bullshit, our regular bullshit. I know you guys have missed us. I mean, we haven't been gone, but we just had guests.
Yeah, I mean, it has been the timing of having guests come on and do their own stories so we didn't have to research anything last month was like chef's kiss, especially
such
around the holidays.
Treat. Yeah. Yes. We're doing this every year now for December.
Yeah, it has to happen. Mm-hmm. Well, so we're recording those episodes in December, but they're released in January for the listeners. So it works out. The timing works out perfectly for everyone because it's less work for us to do in the, you know, pandemonium leading up to the holidays. But it also is like a great way to kick off the new year, I think, as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Having our friends of the pod on, we're definitely going to keep it going because it's so much fun.
I wish we could do guests every episode. It would be way too much to keep track of, but it's so much fun.
It's so much fun. God. Yeah.
So today, it's just the two of us today, but we are entertaining a guest named Tom Collins.
Ha! Stop it. I hate you.
Yes.
I'm just like, wait, today, what? Entertaining a guest?
Huh. Nope. Ooh, wait. What?
Yeah.
Yeah, we are drinking a cocktail today called the Tom Collins.
Over here with my bald eyes and there's a guest.
But you got your microblading done, so it doesn't matter.
I got my eyebrows done, guys. Like, I'm a new woman. Like, don't talk to me. I'm too cute.
My mom just had it done recently, too. She loves it.
Yeah. I've only done the first phase. You have to go twice because it kind of, like, it'll scab over and then it'll just kind of fade color a bit. But that second day after they were done, my eyebrows were so dark. It was glorious. So amazing. The woman who did it, she warned me. She's like, it's going to get really dark, but it's not going to be that color. Like, I have to warn people because they start blowing up my phone like I did something wrong to them. And I'm like, oh, no. Yeah. Meanwhile, I loved it. I'm like, I wish this could stay.
Yeah, that's funny. I've actually thought about doing it myself because for whatever reason, as I've aged, my eyebrows have just lightened up so much. And like, I never even really noticed it was happening because it obviously happened super gradually. Yeah. And then I was looking at pictures from like high school and college and was like, wait a minute, where the fuck have my eyebrows gone?
Really? That's hilarious. Wow. Okay. Now I need to look back at old pictures of you.
Yeah. But Russell said for whatever reason that they haven't really perfected it for men yet because men tend to have like less manicured eyebrows and it tends to look best with like a straight.
No, the woman who did my brows has male clients too.
Oh, just, weird.
You need to come to Colombia. I'll come with you.
I mean, I will. I'll be right there.
I know. Oh my God. Tux is coming for a visit, everyone. It's so exciting.
Yeah, I will. By the time this comes out, I think I'll already be home, but
yeah.
I'm leaving the day after we record this. Yeah, I cannot wait. And maybe I'll be getting my eyebrows done.
I know a great
I know a place. But then I have to go back for the second round.
Yes, you have to be back in 6 weeks for the second one. Yeah.
But yeah, so back to our dear friend Tom Collins here. Yes. So when Stephanie told me that her story today is from 1977, I have to admit, I was deeply disappointed that I was going to have to find yet another terrible cocktail from the 70s that neither of us were going to enjoy very much. But when I started Googling lists of cocktails from the 70s, that's usually, especially like for later eras after like the 50s, I just Google popular cocktails, 1980s, whatever. I kept coming up with lists that were saying have a Tom Collins, drink a Tom Collins. Everybody was drinking Tom Collins in the 70s. And I was like, oh, I wish we could just have a Tom Collins. I know they're delicious, but we've already had one. And then I was like, wait a minute, have we had one? And ended up having to go back and look at our list. There's I mean, this is episode 65.
Damn.
So that means we have had 65 different cocktails or 64 different cocktails before this.
Yeah.
So it's getting hard to keep track of what we've already drank. But what happened was way back in episode 7, we had an individual serving of a gin punch. And that recipe was very similar to a Tom Collins. And basically, the history of the punch that we were drinking, I basically said the cocktail, the Tom Collins, sort of evolved out of this punch recipe that we're drinking.
What was the drink name?
It was called the gin punch.
It was called, just a gin punch. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, but it was essentially, this. It was like gin, lemon juice, a little sweetener, and some soda water. Mm-hmm. But it was originally served as a punch, but I was doing it in individual servings. And I was like, this is actually really similar to a Tom Collins.
Oh, okay.
So, and I kind of talked a little bit in that episode about the history of the Tom Collins, even though I was also telling the history of this gin punch recipe. So while the Tom Collins was super popular in the 1970s, it was actually invented at least 100 years earlier. While we don't know for sure who exactly came up with the recipe, we do know that the first recorded, like written Tom Collins recipe is from the second edition of Jerry Thomas's Bartender's Guide, published in 1876. We also know that the name probably came from this weird prank that was going around New York City in the early 1870s. I think I talked about this in the Gin Punch episode. So if this sounds familiar, just let me know. But basically what was going on was like a bunch of kids or friends or whatever started telling people in bars that a man named Tom Collins was going around the city. This sounds familiar. Yeah.
Yes.
So this man, Tom Collins, is going around the city telling lies about them.
Yeah.
And like saying that they had better find this dude, Tom Collins, who was probably at the bar, and they had to stop him from slandering them even more. So whoever heard this story would run up to the bar and be like, where's Tom Collins? Where's this guy, Tom Collins? And supposedly some bartenders decided to make up a drink that they could serve to anyone who came to the bar asking for Tom Collins.
Okay.
So they're like, the guy comes up, where's Tom Collins? They're like, here he is. You have to pay for this now.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Yeah. So
they hired those kids.
Yeah,
totally. Guerrilla marketing.
Yeah. So from New York, this prank spread to other cities. And in 1874, the Gettysburg compiler wrote, have you seen Tom Collins? If you haven't, perhaps you had better do so. And as quick as you can, for he is talking about you in a very rough manner, calling you hard names and altogether saying things about you that are rather calculated to induce people to believe there is nothing you wouldn't steal short of a red hot stove.
Oh my God, that's incredible.
Yes.
And short of a red hot stove? Wow. That's so weird.
So they go on to say, this is about the cheerful substance of a very successful practical joke, which has been going the rounds of the city in the past week. It is not to this manner born, but belongs to New York, where it was played with some immense success to crowded houses until it played out.
Wow, they apparently just didn't have the internet back then. Like, yeah. This was like fun and games?
Yes, this is fun and games, yeah. So the great Tom Collins hoax of 1874.
What? Stop it.
Yes.
Does this have a wiki page?
That's a good question. I should look into that. So it was so internationally well known that 2 years later, Jerry Thomas included his own Tom Collins recipe in the Bartender's Guide. His initial recipe was kind of a bit complicated, not super complicated, but it called for sort of very specific, hard to find ingredients. So over the years, bartenders started to simplify it into the Tom Collins recipe that we recognize today.
Okay.
So while this seems to be the most commonly accepted origin story for the Tom Collins, Our dear friend, cocktail historian David Wunderich, believes that it actually may have come from a bartender in London whose name was John Collins. He worked at this really popular London hotel in the 1870s, and a lot of the hotels in London at the time were famous for serving gin punches to their clientele. That was sort of just like the drink of the day. Everybody drank gin punch.
Yeah, you can make a batch of it and they just, you know, pour
exactly.
it out. Yeah.
But John Collins worked at this really sort of trendy hotel where young people like to go and party it up, you know, listen to like young people music of the 1870s and get wild.
Oh,
and
no.
Cocktails were a relatively new invention at the time. So young people wanted cocktails. So he basically turned the standard London hotel version of a gin punch into a cocktail. And he called it a John Collins. But it was made with Old Tom Gin.
Okay.
Yes. And then, so it's possible that people just accidentally mixed up the names Tom and John and started calling it a Tom Collins. It is also possible, Wunderich didn't say this, but I'm also thinking that because of the timing of this, that people may have just heard of this, the Tom Collins hoax of 1874. And they're like, oh, yeah, we're just going to have a John Collins or a Tom Collins.
Tom Collins, yeah.
Yeah. So that also is a possibility that both stories are sort of true at the same time. You know? So whichever story is true, maybe they're both true, sort of.
Yeah.
What we do know for sure is that by 1876, the recipe that, you know, that we're, or a variation on the recipe that we're drinking today had found its way into Jerry Thomas's Bartender's Guide. Along with the lemon juice and soda water, Thomas's recipe called for gum syrup as a sweetener.
Oh.
And yeah, likely would have been made with an old world Dutch Genever gin. But instead, modern versions use London dry gin and simple syrup with the lemon juice and soda. So yeah, that's the Tom Collins. Let's take a taste.
Yeah.
When I was a kid at school learning the golden rule, teacher often used to say, if you don't tell a lie, there's not a reason why you can't be like Washington someday. How could Washington be a married man and never, never tell a lie?
It has all of my favorite flavors, so.
It's so good.
It's perfect. So good. It's perfect. Like
the gin is like nice and ginny, junipery, you know, crisp. And then the lemon juice is super bright and tart. There's like just enough simple syrup to sweeten it up a little bit without being too much.
It's not too sweet, but it's, it's so good.
Yeah.
Like I'm surprised we haven't had it before. But yeah, this, I kind of sort of remember the gin punch, but.
This was all the way back in episode 7, so it's been a long time.
Yeah.
The gin punch that we had was basically almost identical to this, but just with sort of a different history. Yeah, it's so tasty, so it's refreshing.
Very, very drinkable.
Anything with
citrus and gin.
Yeah, citrus and gin.
Has me. Like, has a hold on me.
That's our bread and butter. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, well.
Yeah, that's like sort of like a gin Ricky, but with lemon instead of lime.
Oh, yeah.
We loved that gin Ricky, remember?
Yeah, it was just soda water. Yeah.
Soda water, lime juice, gin, and
what era was that? Do you remember? Was that it wasn't the 70s. No.
No, gin Ricky is older. I mean, but this recipe is also older, too. This just happened to still be popular.
Popular in
the
70s. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I feel like the gin Ricky recipe was older, too. But I could have used this cocktail for any era, honestly.
Yeah, it's so good.
But apparently they were really having a moment again in the 1970s.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah. So cool. That's it. That's the Tom Collins.
Yeah.
Our guest for the day.
So yeah, my scandal is from the 1970s. This was a decade of really awful drinks, but also a decade of revolutionary energy and protest culture. The country was in a state of political and social upheaval, which is like, yes, please. It needed to happen. At this time, we had really strong movements for civil rights, for women's rights, for LGBTQ+ rights. We had a powerful opposition to the really corrupt, unjust war against Vietnam at the time. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So these were issues that were driving a lot of people, young and old, into the streets in protest. It was just, yeah, a revolutionary ass time. And many groups were pushing for change and advocating for their rights as citizens. And the disability rights movement was no exception. I don't know if you're familiar. Have you ever heard of the 504 sit-ins?
No, no, not at all.
Okay. So in 1977, hundreds of activists with disabilities took a stand and sparked a movement that would change the course of history for all of us. And that is my scandal today, that protest. Yes. It was known as the 501 sit-ins. It is currently still the longest nonviolent occupation of a federal building in U.S. history.
Wow. Amazing.
Yeah. I found out about this story in researching the assassination of Mayor Moscone and Harvey Milk. I think I mentioned during that episode that there were disabled people who were like holed up in a federal building. You remember
yes,
that?
I do remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. And how Moscone's just like, yeah, and?
Yeah.
Go on.
Yeah. Let them do what they're doing. Yeah.
Yeah. So between April 5th and April 28th, these activists, they organized, they protested, and they occupied government buildings all around the country.
Wow.
Yeah. In order to pressure the Carter administration to enact Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act of 1973. I'm going to get into like what that was. Essentially, they wanted the government to get off their ass and do its job and publish these really long delayed regulations that were a guide to how to enforce this law. Like they wrote a law and they're just like, job done. We did it, y'all. Mission accomplished. Like, and the disabled community is like, nah, bitch, no.
You didn't do anything.
You did nothing. You wrote some words down.
Yeah.
So it was basically vibes. Like they wrote down some words and they, you know, they're just like, we're listening and we're learning, but we're not going to put anything into action.
Yeah, good vibes only.
Good vibes, exactly. Right. So, but first, a toast. Let us raise this toast is one of my favorite toasts. Let us raise our glass very high to this toast. Feels evergreen. It feels like a toast for every season to forcing the Democrats to do the right thing. Because that's not their natural inclination. Cheers.
Not at all. Oh my God.
Right? To forcing them to do their fucking jobs. So, as I said, the events leading up to this 504 sit-in, it stemmed from a failure of the U.S. government to do its job to enforce this Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act. This act came out of, well, I guess was inspired by the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And it mandated that people with disabilities should be integrated into mainstream institutions like everyone else. Like we can't just have different classes of people. Like, you know, this is not what this country professes to be about. And yet.
Yeah.
And Jeez. Yet. So the language was really broad. This is a like a quote from the 504 section. It said that no qualified individual with a disability should, only by reason of his or her disability, be excluded from the participation in or be denied the benefits of or be subject to discrimination under any program or activity receiving federal assistance. So it's basically saying that if you get government money, you can't discriminate against this class of people.
Sure.
Duh, right?
Great.
But because this bill went before the Nixon administration, he was kind of like, I'm not signing this. Like, this would regulate corporations. And that's, I'm not going to be doing that. I'm not going to be expanding the federal government. Mm-hmm. That's bad.
That means, yeah. That you're taking it from good vibes to good deeds, and we can't have that.
No, we can't. We can't. So in 1972, a group called Disabled in Action, they demonstrated in New York City. They organized some sit-ins protesting one of the vetoes. I think he vetoed it like four times. So it was trash, you know, this man. I'm not surprised.
Just as I thought.
Exactly. Just as I thought. So this protest, it was done on Madison Ave, like prime shopping area in New York City. They shut down traffic. It was a big thing. It was led by a woman named Judith E. Heumann. And she would become a key player in these later sit-ins. She had a lot of organizing experience from other civil rights kind of demonstrations. So her and 80 of her besties, they had a sit-in on Madison Ave. They stopped traffic. So events like this, because this happened in many cities, not just New York, in D.C., L.A., and in San Francisco, there were demonstrations like this protesting that they were kind of refusing to make any regulations to this law because, I mean, they had a lot of excuses, but essentially they thought it put an undue burden on corporations and smaller local governments to, yeah, your face.
I just, like, you're getting so much money from the government.
Yes.
You know. That's the whole thing is like you're getting, if you weren't getting money from the government, you wouldn't have to participate in this.
Correct. Correct.
So yes. Use some of that fucking money to like
exactly.
Put it in an elevator or do whatever you gotta do.
Yes. Widen a staircase. Like just, yeah, it's crazy. Yeah. This is not targeting private business. This is targeting businesses who are getting federal funds. Like
ridiculous.
It's so, yeah, it's ridiculous. So it's worth noting that before the passage of this law, disability had been defined by what's called as a medical model of rehabilitation. It meant that disabled people were supposed to be like basically trying to be like able-bodied people. That was the goal. And it was very like paternalistic.
That's not possible for some people.
Thank you. Yeah.
Like, that's great if you're talking about like somebody who needs physical rehabilitation to get back to being able-bodied in the way they once were or could be. Mm-hmm. But like, that's not the case for a lot of probably majority of disabled people.
Yeah, no, it's true. So these laws, they started in the colonial era and they were created to protect like the wider community from the financial burden of having to care for people with disabilities. So just as a caveat, I learned a lot about disability history researching this story. And mm-hmm. I learned that saying like disabled person, while it's not like, you know, incorrect, it's not what they would like to be called. They prefer terms that lead with their humanity, person with a disability,
okay,
people with
sure.
disability, people living with disability. So great. I adjusted my outline, but if I slip up, just please auto-correct it in your mind. I'm trying to be better, but we don't learn about things like this and how words have meaning.
No, exactly. It's always a journey. And it's, I mean, even for us, you know, every time I'm writing a new story, I'm constantly trying to adjust the way I use our language because...
Yeah.
Like you said, words have meaning.
Words have meaning in language evolves. Like thankfully I Googled it because like my whole outline was like disabled person. And I'm like, okay, I'm saying the things. I'm not saying like, I mean, there's so many horrible terms that, you know, I'm not even going to say.
Of course.
But
yeah.
Thankfully I Googled it and I'm like, oh, of course. Like I get this.
Yeah.
So I adjusted everything, but just in case it comes back out. I'm trying.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's the important thing is recognizing that, you know, you have something to learn and it's adjusting to that.
Yeah. And I think it's good to let other people know because I had no clue. Like here I was being like, okay, I got this. Like, but let me just Google it. Let me just make sure. During the 20th century, there were a lot of efforts to improve the condition of people living with disabilities. It was mostly focused on veterans until FDR. So yeah, FDR was a turning point. He helped to establish a lot more regulation and also just like rights for people living with disabilities.
Is his like influence part of the reason that there was a focus on sort of like rehabilitation rather than just accepting that some people live with disabilities? Because he himself was so focused on trying to like regain the use of his legs. Yes,
he was. Yeah. And his family spent a lot of money on, are you familiar with the March of Dimes?
Yes.
Organization, which like I learned recently, like that's why he's on the dime.
Oh,
yeah.
I didn't know that.
I learned that in my research, but yeah, I think I'm not 100% if like he's the reason why, or like that was just the vibe, like the movement of the day. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of it, I mean, yeah. I cut a lot from my outline because there's a lot in disability history in the era of eugenics that I've kind of touched upon that I think I might, I don't know. There's a lot of minis that I could do that could spin off of this, but I didn't look too deeply into FDR other than his administration because they had such a long time in office. They did a lot for people with disabilities. And also his family did a lot of like financing research. Okay. And I think some of it was like not good at all. Like very eugenics-y.
Yeah. That's some of it. I mean, I'm sure that has a lot to do with the time period.
Yeah.
That was just super popular at the time.
Yeah. That's what like that was the progressive view, unfortunately. Yeah. So even after FDR was doing all of these great things, or at least he was doing things for Americans.
I'm sure that some of the things he was doing were good.
That's true. Some of it was really good. But people were still being institutionalized and they were still being denied basic rights and a lot of opportunity. Many of them weren't allowed to work, even if they could. There was just a lot of discrimination. So the Rehabilitation Act of 1973 was supposed to change all of that. Like everyone was so excited when this was signed into law and they're like, let's go. But so just to backtrack a little bit to talk about how people with disabilities felt at the time, because there was a culture of paternalism and, you know, eugenics was still floating around. People with living with disabilities, they internalized their oppression. Mm-hmm. They really thought that, oh, I can't attend this university because I can't walk. Yeah. And that's my own personal problem.
Yeah.
Most of these people, they did not think the issues that they faced daily were the product of prejudice or discrimination. I found a quote from an activist who I'm going to be quoting a lot because she's an author and a disability rights activist, and she's still kicking it and still pushing people. And I'm obsessed with her. So she said that at the time that there was no access for disabled people, no right to an education. There was no public transit. You couldn't get into a library or a city hall, much less a courtroom. There were no federally mandated social services or agencies for individuals living with disabilities. If an individual wanted to hire an in-home attendant or even just an interpreter, they had to happen through a pre-existing social network. Yeah. And a lot of people didn't have that. So
of course,
there was a lot of people just left out, like people on the margins. And with the passing of this bill, people living with disabilities, they started to talk about like, oh yeah, we should be able to go to a court or go to a library. Like, it is fucked up that we can't take our wheelchairs into public spaces like everyone else.
Yeah.
So they started to understand disability as a societal problem, not a personal failing, as what the culture had told them prior to this. So with this law, discrimination of people with disabilities was now legally documented, and this was a massive first step. However, for the law to become effective, it needed regulation
and enforcement.
Yes. Like at this time, they had no definition for like who was a disabled person. Or
I was going to ask that, like, what did that mean in this law? But it was just sort of like,
Yeah, it meant whatever you wanted to mean. Like, there was no rubric for like what constituted discrimination or non-discrimination in what context. It was just words, basically. Like they didn't go any deeper than the surface. They didn't have any sort of timeline for enforcement. They had no enforcement, period. So in the absence, right? Like the fact that they wrote this law and thought that their job was done is offensive. What is the purpose of this?
Yeah.
Like who, what?
So they signed the Clean Air Act and Clean Water Act, and they're just like, it's done. All the rivers and lakes and all the smog, it's all gone. Everything's great. It's all
gone. Look at this. Points to document.
Yeah.
So in the absence of any sort of code or regulation, there are a lot, if you can believe this, there are a lot of contradictory rulings.
Yeah.
Who could have imagined that judges would just wildly interpret the law in different ways based on their own, you know, preconceived notions about people living with disabilities. So there was one case, I mean, there were so many cases, but there was one case that involved the right of a wheelchair user to use a public bus, in which the decision said that if the driver stopped and opened the doors, that was non-discrimination.
What?
Yeah.
And it was up to the person in the wheelchair to be able to figure it out from there?
Just to fly up the stairs. In the same week, another case acknowledged that steps, prevented a wheelchair user from boarding.
In the
same week, yeah.
Two different judges in different places.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Wild. So things like this were happening all over the country. Like, it was wild. So the HEW had to have really strong laws so all the other government agencies could like kind of piggyback off of it. So between 1973, when this law went on to the books, in 1977, no regulations were issued.
Jesus Christ.
4 years of just like nothing.
It's on the books. That's the important part.
We did what you guys wanted.
We're not going to do a single fucking thing to enforce it at all.
Yeah.
Jesus.
So all the while, people living with disabilities, they're like, fuck this. Like, you guys
garbage.
Need to make a law that has teeth, that has rules, so different localities can follow these rules. Like, it shouldn't be this difficult, and yet here we are.
Yeah.
So during this period, there were many civil rights attorneys who sent working with these organizations that helped people living with disabilities. These lawyers, they basically did their job for them. They essentially wrote regulations and they were just like, hey, sign these, make these laws. Like, since it's too hard for you guys to do your job, like, we did it for you.
Mm-hmm.
They sent it to the secretary of the HEW. They said, like, hey, this is our recommendation. Like, we've passed this around. Like, everyone agrees that, like, this is basically what we want. And they asked them to, because I guess the process is that you have to publish, or at least the process at that time was that you had to publish laws to something called this Federal Register. And after it was in the Federal Register, it would be open to public debate, and then it would go through the normal, you know, process.
Okay.
So they published this recommendation, they sent it to the Federal Register, and then nothing. Crickets.
Jesus.
Crickets. And this stalling, this 4 years of just nothing, it allowed a lot of opposition to grow from hospitals, from universities, from state and county governments. They were all saying like, oh, you know, we don't have the funds, even though you're giving us funds, we don't have the funds to make any changes. but don't look at our books. We just, trust us, we don't have the funds. We're doing other things with that money that you sent us. So the HEW, and this is wild. So many different accounts that I read were like, this is not what you're supposed to do. The HEW, they sent these regulations to Congress. It was so unusual. Congress sent them right back like, what the fuck is this? Like, do your own work. Like,
but we already did the work. You guys do your work now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
Yes. Precisely. So the HEW, because they were being forced, they're like, okay, we have to do something. So they publish what they called a, quote, intent to purpose regulations, which is basically they're saying that we need to study things more, even though we had 4 years and we sat on our ass and we did nothing. We need, this is, we're going to propose something, just give us time. And again, crickets. Okay. During this time, the American Coalition of Citizens with Disabilities, the ACCD, was formed. This group formed only with the sole purpose of forcing DC to make regulations. They're like, bet, like, if you're not going to do anything, we are going to create an organization to be up in your ass.
Exactly.
And not in a good way. Yeah. Not in a pleasurable way. Like,
yeah, you're not going to just sit here and fucking act like you did like the work already when you haven't done shit.
Yeah.
And we're going to tell you every day.
Yeah. Amazing. So once the Carter administration was in office, activists were so excited. They're like, finally, we have someone who's going to listen. They're going to sign this into law. It's going to be great. We're going to get regulations. Like, they're going to change things. We're going to be able to be full citizens. About that.
Yeah, I don't know about all this.
I know. But we all know that excitement when there's
a more progressive candidate.
Yeah, when there's a sea change to be like, oh my God, like, this is our time, this is our moment. Like, we have all of our ducks in a row. Like, this is gonna be great. And it wasn't great.
Shocking.
So instead of signing these fucking regulations, the HEW, they set up yet another task force with
much time has passed at this point?
So it's been like 4.5 years now.
Okay.
Yeah. So they set up this task force. Of course, there's no representation from the community.
Yeah.
Or there's no people living with disabilities there.
They don't have access to the building, probably.
Yes. Not probably, definitely.
Yeah.
There was no access. This task force was supposed to study them, which is like, no, nothing about us without us. Fuck this. So it became really, really clear through all of the delays, through all of the excuses. There were also some leaks that said basically that they were trying to weaken the regulations that were sent by the civil rights lawyers. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. This is St. Carter's administration, y'all. So the ACCD, again, this is that organization that was set up to just be on them. They demanded regulations and they set a time limit. They said you have until April 4th, 1977, to write these laws. Don't water them down. Don't change them. We have perfected these laws over the past 4.5 years. Just sign the documents.
And what?
Yeah. So they warned that they were going to have protests the next day if nothing happened.
Okay. I see.
Yeah. Yeah. They said that there was going to be a sit-in at 8 different HEW regional headquarters all around the country if they did nothing. If the secretary, this guy named Joseph Califano, if he didn't sign this into law, they were going to find out the following day. This concludes the fucking around portion.
Come back after this message and you'll find out.
You will find out.
Amazing.
Jeez,
and looks like we're live here.
I'm one of your hosts, Hamish.
And I'm your other host, Aaron Conway.
And welcome to our show,
The Third Wheel.
And today we're joined by...
Hello everyone, I'm Anna Blackburn.
I'm Josh.
My name's James.
Yes, I'm Nish.
My name's Sneja.
I'm Gina.
Hi everyone, I'm Lil.
This is Jakeshri.
I'm Tam.
Hi, I'm Deja.
I'm Nicol.
I'm Ashley.
My name's Dar.
I'm Shami.
That's just a few of our previous guests. Every episode we're joined by a Third Wheel to hear their story, debate some juicy topics and play some games. You can find us everywhere at thirdwheel.fm and follow us on Instagram, Twitter and Facebook at thethirdwheelfm.
Like jumping on this podcast, The Third Wheel. I love being The Third Wheel right now. It's fantastic.
They were done playing these games. They said, you have 24 hours, bitch. Make it happen. Okay. Or we're going to make something else happen.
Yeah, okay.
So hundreds of people arrived in San Francisco. They came with backpacks, bulging with food. They came with their medication. They had all of their supplies. They had their caregivers, the ones who needed caregivers. This group included adults, teenagers, support staff, and parents with their kids. They came from all around the Bay Area, and they were really diverse from like a socioeconomic perspective, which was nice to see. Again, this was back in the 70s when poor people could afford to live in San Francisco. Back in the day. So this crowd, it was mostly people who were blind, deaf, people who were using wheelchairs. There were some people who arrived that were living with mental disabilities. And there were people who were paraplegic and quadriplegic as well. And in cities across the country that morning, similarly diverse groups assembled to picket their regional office of the HEW. There were demonstrations in Atlanta, Boston, Chicago, Dallas, Denver, Philadelphia, New York, and Seattle, as well as the largest demonstration was in D.C., obviously, right?
Yeah.
So there were about 300 people in Washington, D.C. who marched to and then demonstrated inside of the office of the secretary of the HUW, Joseph Califano. They arrive and he vanishes. You know, he just had a meeting. He just got called out, you guys. Coincidence. Thankfully, he understood the optics of like, people arrive to hold you accountable and you just disappear? Curious. Very, very curious. So he met with a few representatives. He met with the head of the ACCD, a man named Frank Bowell. And even as they push him, he's like, we just need to do more study, guys.
Oh, like, my God.
We're not, we don't feel comfortable. We don't feel confident in making regulations, even though you're providing us with them. We just need to do more study, you know?
You have had an entire presidential term plus to figure this fucking out.
Yes.
What's the holdup?
Correct. The holdup is maintaining the status quo, which is, I think, the role of Democrats sometimes. In my darkest days, I feel like that is what they do. So he met with these protesters. He met with these leaders of these organizations, and still he refused to sign the regulations. This action in D.C., it led the protesters to be like, okay, fine, we're camping here, bitch. Like, we're going to wait. If you need another 24 hours, we're going to be here. But these protesters, they had to leave after 28 hours because they did not plan to be there overnight. They thought that, hey, there's enough of us. We're going to force him to do the right thing. So they had to leave for food-related reasons and for some people for medical reasons because they did not bring the medications that they needed to be in D.C. in a long, like, you know, in a long stay type of situation. Yeah, so they made it this 28 hours. The FBI also put pressure on them, which was really, really shitty. They, like, cut power to the building.
Oh, and it's like, God.
These people are living with disability. Like, what are you? They wanted them out, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
So most of the protests ended that day in these different cities. However, San Francisco kept going. The San Francisco protest was planned by Judith Human, which I mentioned earlier, Kitty Cohn, who was a queer leader in the city, and Mary Jane Owen. These women were like, had planned for this. Mm-hmm. And this is the power, I think, of women who have access to power. Like, they're able to plan, they're able to strategize, they're able to work with other people. So for years, Human and Cohn had been laying the groundwork amongst just the local population. They worked with organizations, community members, and they also did a lot of outreach to people who were living with disabilities, and they educated them about their rights. Because these people, they weren't really following the news, and like, also there was no real news happening.
Yeah,
so they were letting them know that, hey, there's this law in the books that they're not enforcing because they ain't shit. Do you want to come and protest with us? And they're like, hell yes, we do. Yeah. So they realized early, Human and Cohn, that they wanted to plan something bigger and something that was a bit more accessible for their community. They wanted to put real pressure on the local, like, HEW director, a man named Joseph Maldano, who reported to his boss in Washington, Joseph Califano. They sound very similar.
Yeah.
The Josephs ain't shit. That's all you need to know. The Josephs ain't shit.
I was actually going to ask, was this chapter of the organization the only one that was run by women?
They were the only ones, yes.
So they were the only ones prepared.
Yes.
because women were in charge.
In leadership roles, all women, like, it was only women in leadership roles, and two of the women were queer. So yeah.
Yeah.
They were doing shit, and they were planning to do shit.
Yeah. They were not believing that the government was going to just be like, "Oh, 24 hours, we got this."
Oh, you're right. You're so right. Yeah. They knew. Yeah. They weren't like, oh, if we ask, they're going to do it. No, they're not.
And if we show up for like 3 hours, they're going to be like, oh, okay, you're here. Well, I guess I gotta.
Yeah. Yeah, no, they were living in reality.
Yes.
These women. Yes.
Yeah.
So they had been planning this for years, actually, because they knew that it had to be big. And they had 4.5 years to be shown that the government is not going to do shit. They're just not going to do it.
Yeah.
You have to do something really, really big. So because they were organizing people who were living with disabilities, there were a lot of logistical challenges to just people getting there, people using public transportation. That's something that we definitely take for granted. But due to the physical nature of the people who were protesting, they knew that it was going to be difficult to move a large number of people back and forth to like the federal building every day. And the federal building was inaccessible. Like, this was one of the things that 504 was supposed to address.
Yeah.
So they knew that, like, once we get here, we just need to hold the building. We can't go back and forth. We need to stay here and make this building our home.
I love that the government, like, not only did they not force corporations to like follow the law that they just wrote into law, they didn't follow it themselves.
No, no, they most certainly did not. So these women, they planned for a larger occupation in advance, but they planned in a way where they didn't alert too many participants, because they would learn later, they had some suspicions that the FBI was monitoring them, and that was correct.
Yeah.
They were on watch lists. So they didn't want to tell too many people because they didn't want law enforcement to, you know, hear things they weren't supposed to hear, which is crazy. It's like, while you're surveilling a man in a wheelchair pushing for his rights. Okay, cool.
This is what the FBI is spending their time doing.
Yeah. Yes.
You're not trying to stop like terrorists from trying to blow buildings up. You're literally trying to stop anyone who wants more rights from pushing the status quo forward.
You're trying to prevent children in wheelchairs from getting to the library.
Like poor Black children from having lunch. Like,
yeah.
This is what you're spending your time doing. Killing people. So to make sure that poor children can't have food.
Correct. Correct. I mean, it's always a good time.
What this a great, like, use of taxpayer monies.
Oh, yes. So So they didn't want, you know, the 5-0 to get wise. So they're like, okay, it can only be like 100 of us, but like, you know, don't tell nobody, but come here and like bring your shit. So this is really fucked up, but also really amazing. So just because of the way that people felt about, because of all the discrimination towards people living with disabilities, they never saw the shit coming, like at all.
Yeah.
They thought, they look at these people with pity. They're just like, there's no way that they can, like, you know, have
they
a protest.
They can't do anything. That. Yeah.
Exactly. They can't do anything.
Yeah.
And because of those sentiments, like, these protesters were able to, like, make use of that really fucked up, like, you know, that pity that they got from the public. They never saw this coming. And also, when they did take the building, the local government was very afraid of like a PR nightmare.
Sure. Like, what, you're going to like drag people out of their wheelchairs in the street in front of cameras and shit?
Yes. And most of them are children. So they're just like, we can't arrest little Johnny in his wheelchair. This is bad. Their whole thing was like, oh, like how long can they last? Like, just look
exactly. We just have to wait it out. And and that's all they needed to do in everywhere. It wasn't run by queer women who knew what they were up against.
Yeah. And planned for the resistance. Like, I'm going to get into it, but like these women are, two of them are still alive. Like, the planning that they did was truly inspiring. Like, this story is, I'm holding it together, but this story is like very emotional for me because it's amazing on so many levels. So the protesters who occupied the federal building in San Francisco, they were mostly young. Most of the people were under 25. It was a very racially diverse group. It was like 50-50, like non-white to white, which was kind of amazing. But again, this is back in the 70s when people could afford to be in San Francisco. Unlike most of the other protest movements at the time, the 504 occupation was led by women, and it had queer women at the forefront, as opposed, I mean, the feminist movement was run by women, but they pushed the queer women to the back.
Yeah,
they let them do logistics, but like they were never up front. Like, the queer women were up front in this movement, which was really amazing. So they climbed to the HEW's fourth floor. That was where Maldonado's office was. And they refused to leave. Initially, the HEW, they did what they did in other cities. They used these tactics. They shut off the power. They tried to do all this, you know, fucked up shit. But because it was San Francisco and there was this environment of activism and social justice, many of these protesters had outside supporters and allies. Yeah. So they knew that they couldn't go like too far or the news of it all. Again, that PR sort of nightmare that they were afraid of. They like went to a point. They didn't do what they did in D.C., in San Francisco, because they couldn't. So there were a number of people who were involved in the 501 protests that had previously participated in the civil rights movement and the anti-Vietnam War protests. So they were able to instruct everyone else, like, this was not their first rodeo. Like, they knew how, unfortunately, how to deal with the FBI, and they provided a lot of know-how. And it's sad that they had to do that, but like, it was such great like community knowledge to be like, this is what they're going to try to do, and this is what we're going to do in response. Like, amazing. So protesting, like, we've gone to protest together.
And actually, we were just at the Women's March. Well, the day that we are recording this is the anniversary, because I saw on my time hop
today, is
to the day, like, 4 years ago, the last time we went to the Women's March, pre-COVID.
Oh my God, I remember that.
Yeah.
Wow, to the day. Yeah. So fucking cold. Crazy.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you felt this, but like that day, I was so fucking tired. And we weren't even out there like all day.
No,
but like
not at
the following day, like, my back hurt. So yeah, protesting is a lot. It's very taxing on your body. Even if you're just standing around, And for many of these protesters, the 504 sit-ins was the first time that they spent any time like outside of their house.
Yeah.
Sleeping or even just like living, existing for a long period of time outside their house. And many,
I can't imagine, like, the, you know, right? You have to have a certain system to make things. I mean, I'm sure it must have sort of been exhilarating at the same time to like.
Yeah, I'm going to get into that. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. The atmosphere was, yeah, definitely exhilarating. It's, yeah, I'm going to get into it. But it was the first time a lot of people living with disabilities like met others who had either had their disability or had different disabilities. Like the whole community vibe of it all was really, really nice.
It must have been, yeah, really. I mean, as much as I'm sure it was very difficult, I'm sure it was also really fun for people to like meet a bunch of new people and
I mean, it seems like, well, no, I shouldn't say it seems. I was going to say it seems like their biggest hurdle was just getting there because transit was so bad back then.
Sure, yeah.
Like so, so bad. If you had a wheelchair, you basically had to be like in the back of a van to get anywhere. But inside, once inside of the HGW offices, their needs for just like a comfortable space like became really apparent. And they knew this going into it and they tried to make some accommodations, but it was a lot for some people. Yeah, I think it would be a lot for anyone, actually.
Yeah, absolutely.
For anyone. It would be a lot for me just sleeping on the floor, let alone
I'm too old for that shit. I'm not sleeping. Right? I used to love camping. Yeah. I need an air mattress and like outlets. And
so most of these people were like 25.
Still.
Totally. Yeah. I'm not saying like, oh, they should suck it up. I'm just saying like the fact that you feel like you can't be on the ground now.
Yes. Yeah. I'm different. Not sleeping on hard dirt anymore.
Yeah. No. Those days are long past you. So there were people who had most of the people had very, very special needs. There were people who required space for walking aids, for wheelchairs, people who were deaf. They needed their translators. Most of their translators were there, but there were some people who were like sharing translators, which was amazing. The protesters with paraplegia and quadriplegia, they needed assistance to lift and turn them every so often, especially when they were sleeping or when they were sitting for long periods to prevent sores. So over the course of a lot of weeks, they did have like kind of, yeah, rudimentary accommodations. They were fucking serious though.
Amazing.
These protesters, they compromised their health to achieve their goals.
Yeah.
And some of them live with a toll of just this, I think it was 28 days. For years, they live with like,
Yeah. Like, they're not asking for much.
No, they're asking for you to enforce a law that you wrote.
It's already law. You passed it.
Yeah.
All they're asking is for you to enforce it.
Yeah. For you to make rules and regulations so it can be enforced nationwide. That's what federal laws are supposed to do. So, like, they're not asking for anything really. You know, mess. Oh, so I know this is like supposed to be my fun story. It has a good ending. You guys stay with me. It has a good ending. So just a bit about the Bay Area. And I think most people already know this, but like I did learn a little bit. So the Bay Area, definitely. I don't think this could have happened in any other place because of not just because it was such a politically progressive place, but they had a high density of people living with disabilities because they had access to public transit, because they had good weather, because they had wide and well-maintained sidewalks. It made that area really desirable for people with disabilities.
Was public transit accessible?
No.
In San Francisco?
Okay. I mean, people are really kind and would help, but no.
I see. Okay.
Yeah. So by one estimate, there were 400 people living with disabilities in Berkeley in 1972. 4 years later, that number was closer to 5,000.
Wow.
Yeah. So they kind of had like a critical mass at this point. They had enough people who were all in the community. They could reach out and talk to them like, hey, even if you can't come to the building, like we kind of need your help in whatever capacity you can manage. And again, because it's organized by women, like it was so grassroots, like they went door to door. and they talk to people, they talk to parents, like they talk to people at yeah, they did all of the things. Like they follow the playbook of the civil rights movement, mm-hmm. and they were really committed to this event, and they knew that it was going to take a lot of support.
Yeah, yeah.
So San Francisco, as all of us know, in the 1970s, had a lot of, like I said, it had a lot of disabled people living with disabilities, but there was also a huge LGBTQ plus community, obviously. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of Black folks there. That's where the Black Panthers started in San Francisco.
Oh, I didn't know that, actually.
Yeah, yeah, Oakland.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So these marginalized populations, they are accustomed to a type of cooperation I think is lacking in the greater society. There is an interdependence. There's an assumption that, like, I need you to survive. Like, we need each other. There's community, essentially.
Sure.
And community was necessary. Like, it was the critical factor in this protest, this 504 protest. So there were 100 plus, they say it was around 120 plus occupiers, but they also came with their attendants, and immediately they started making the space their own. They draped like plastic over air conditioning units, and they turned that into areas that could store their medication. They turned them basically into fridges. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, I mean,
that's so cool.
I think people with disabilities and also just marginalized people are resourceful. Like
you have to be.
You have to be. So they use payphones to communicate with their loved ones and the media until the FBI cut their phone lines.
Trash. FBI.
The FBI is going to FBI you guys.
That they are.
So they had meetings every day. Like they had, I guess, kind of similar to, I'm sure Occupy borrowed this just from like civil rights and like protests in general, but they had like meetings every day. Like everything was done like by committee. They were always talking to each other. So they started strategizing ways to respond to false bomb scares because they knew that that was possible. This was like the FBI's MO was to call in a bomb scare to a place where people were organizing. Like,
yeah. So that everyone would leave and would leave. They could close down the building. Yeah,
exactly. So they started to basically do drills for this. Like, we're not fucking going anywhere. We're going to check for bombs ourselves, but there's no bombs here. But we're not fucking going anywhere. Wow. They're not going to get us, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Incredible. So despite their rough, very rough accommodations, most of them were just sleeping on the floor on the stairs. Like, I'm going to put a lot of, there's amazing video. I think I can clip the video and put it on online, but also there's great photographs about this whole event. But there, the protesters, like the vibe was like they were having a good time despite aches and pains and just, you know, the physicality of it all. Their spirits were very high. There was a lot of sex happening.
Amazing. Like, I love that
a lot
for them.
Of sex. Apparently yes, there was like one it. Elevator. Was just like you
the
went
sex
there
elevator?
To have sex. Yes,
I want to go to the sex elevator.
Thank you. Same. Can I please, mother? May I go to the sex elevator? So they played cards. This was the time of Passover and Easter. They had Passover and Easter celebrations. Women took turns washing each other's hair in the bathroom sinks, like. There's all these videos, really cool videos. I hope I can put them online. But O'Toole, she wasn't a main organizer, but she was one of the people who was at the 405 protest. She recalls a deaf man because the FBI had cut the phone lines, trash. Mm-hmm. So there were people who were outside of the building who were able to communicate versus via sign language.
Through the windows and stuff.
Through the windows, yes.
That's amazing.
Right? So good.
Oh my God, I love that.
It's like you thought you were going to stop us, but like we have other ways.
Yeah.
We have nonverbal ways to communicate, bitch. Okay? Yeah. Oh my God. It's
incredible.
This whole story is just, it's so, so inspiring.
So what were the people who worked in this building, what were they doing while this was all happening?
they were not allowed in the building. Yeah.
Oh, even like the director was not there while this was all going down.
Yeah. I'm going to get into this, but the Black Panther Party provided support
for
this protest.
Okay. Okay. Oh, like refusing to let people in.
Yeah.
I see. Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Right?
That's incredible. Yeah.
So this woman who was at the protests, was at the occupation, I should say. She saw like this deaf man communicating to this crowd. He's like half out the window and she's like holding him back so he doesn't like fall out of the window as he's communicating their message, because the FBI cut the phone lines. So they didn't want the press communicating with them, basically.
Yeah.
They didn't want, they didn't want anyone else knowing about it. And they're just like, we have other ways. So they had formed a committee, the occupiers. They gave everyone a job. You were either doing food, you were on like safety. Again, this is women organizing. Mm-hmm. You were doing cleanup, you were in charge of entertainment or communication. They had people who were in charge of fundraising. They're like, if you have rich friends, they need to send us their coins right now.
Right. Yeah.
So those who couldn't occupy the HEW offices, they held daily rallies because they wanted that public and like media attention every single day. They're like, we're still here, bitch. This is probably one of my favorite parts of the story. So the Salvation Army, they gave the protesters cots and blankets so they wouldn't have to sleep on the floor.
Oh, good for them.
Yeah.
It's because they were disabled, not queer. I'm sorry, people with disabilities and not queer.
Yes, yes. So the mayor also lended his support, as I mentioned earlier. He was one of the biggest supporters of the group, and he would eventually travel to D.C. with them to force the government to do the right thing.
Yeah, good
and
for him.
That's so sad. It's like, this is the guy who was assassinated. Like, he could have done so much.
Yeah, that's how you get assassinated.
You're right. You're right. Way to bring reality into this. So the biggest issue was really them being comfortable, but also food. Food was needed to keep the protests going. And initially, because again, they underestimated the strength of this community, initially people were able to go and leave. Like, they could leave, they could gather money, they gather donations for food, they could get food. But eventually there came a time where they weren't letting them leave the building. They're just like, if you leave, you're not coming back in. And they're like, okay. Well, we're going to stay. But McDonald's, this is my favorite part. McDonald's and Safeway contributed food. That's in the spirit amazing. Of guests helping the handicap.
Oh, okay.
They contributed food until they realized that it was civil disobedience.
Yeah.
They're like, I thought you guys were just hungry. you're trying to push for rights. No, we're not gonna. And they stop like, giving them food.
Yeah, they're like, wait, if you get these lost pass, we're gonna have to pay to put, like, oh my god, never mind.
Not though, because they're not getting public funds. But
I mean, eventually though, they didn't know this was coming down the line, but eventually they would.
Yeah,
they didn't know about the ADA.
No, they didn't know about the ADA. Stream. Yeah. So it was funny that they gave food and then they stopped. They're like, you guys are doing
That's
bad things.
Ridiculous.
Yeah. Right?
Bad things.
Yeah. I mean,
asking for your rights.
Yes. How dare you? We thought we were being the white knights.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
So I mentioned previously that the Black Panther Party was involved, and they're kind of an often ignored, I wonder why, group that really helped the success of this movement. I don't think they would have lasted as long as they did without the Black Panther Party doing what they did. The party, they understood what it meant to be intersectional. They supported all revolutionary movements at the time. And they had a few members who were living with disability. There was a man named Bradley Lomax. He was a Panther. He joined the 504 sit-ins on day one, along with his assistant, Chuck Jackson. He assisted a lot of other people who were there that day and throughout the duration of the protests. And because of that, the Black Panthers were just like, whatever you guys need, we are here for you. they released a statement that said, we support you because you're asking America to change, to treat you like human beings, like you belong. Mm-hmm. We always support people fighting for their rights.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. So when the FBI tried to prevent them from delivering food, the Panthers held their ground. They're like, okay, we're just going to stand here with our guns and we'll see what's what. Mm-hmm. So beginning that first week, continuing until the end of the occupation, local Panthers cooked and carried food, hot meals across the bay from Oakland to San Francisco every single day. That's until amazing. The end of the occupation. They never asked for money. They're just like, you are engaged in the revolutionary struggle and we support you.
Amazing.
The end.
I love that. Yes.
Right? But this is how, this is collective action.
Yeah.
We used to know how to do it, but like this, this story is just, yeah, it's everything. So of the 120 or so protesters, 14 individuals with disabilities and 8 of their attendants, they were selected to go to DC to force a meeting with Califano because they had held the building for weeks and they're just like, okay, nothing's happening. We are getting media attention, which is great, but like nothing's happening in DC. Like we need to go to fucking DC. We need to make them do what they said that they were going to do. And this was a unanimous decision. Again, like everything was consensus driven because it was organized by women. They're like, we're not just going to do power play shit. Like we're going to vote on this. We're going to deliberate. We're going to make power moves together.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Oh, my God. I fucking love this story. So these people leave the building and the FBI is like, oh, we got them. Some of them left. We got this.
Oh, so you didn't know.
They didn't know. They didn't know at all. So, yeah, the FBI, who had been monitoring the building, still didn't really get like, oh, like their solidarity is a thing. What? Community is a thing. These hoes thought with 22 people gone that they could just roll up into this building and that they could force the remaining people to leave. And they couldn't be more wrong.
Yeah.
So they started with the false bomb scares and they were ready.
For fuck's sake.
They were ready. They're just like, okay, let this fake bomb go off.
Yeah. We'll be here.
Looks at watch.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nothing happens. So once the DC contingent, once they left, yeah, the San Francisco occupiers, their only focus was holding the building because they knew that without sustained media coverage, like people are just going to continue to ignore their plight. They needed that building and they held on to it. So yeah. The protesters in DC, they arrived with Mayor Moscone, which is again, amazing. They also had another partner on the ground in DC, the Machinists Union, the people who like had a bunch of U-Hauls. They're like, hey, if you guys in wheelchairs, like we can transport you around. It's going to be dark back there, but like we can hold all of you.
Amazing.
Right? So yeah. They arrive in DC. The Machinists like bring them to Califano's office, basically. Mm-hmm. And they protest outside at first. They're singing hymns from the civil rights movement. They're singing We Shall Overcome. There's a lot of press coverage. It's amazing. The co-organizers of the protest in San Francisco, Judy Heumann, she gave a really amazing speech. I just have like a small quote. I'm going to put video of this on Instagram. But she said, I can tell you that every time you raise the issue of separate but equal, the outrage of disabled individuals across this country is going to continue. It's going to be ignited. There will be more takeovers of buildings until maybe you begin to understand our position. We will no longer allow the government to oppress disabled individuals. We want the law enforced, which is not too much to ask.
Not just at all.
Enforce the law that you wrote.
If you didn't like, want to, if
why
you
do
didn't
we got to do enforce, all this?
Why'd you sign it into law in the first place?
Thank you. Thank you. That is the question. It's like they're not asking for the moon. They're asking for you to make the law that you fucking wrote real.
Yeah.
So in the following days, because I mean, Democrats are better than Republicans generally, but still they're not about doing right things unless force, it seems. So in the days that followed, the group followed them everywhere they went because they had this U-Haul that would just take them like, okay, he's over here now. They caught President Carter at church. Man had to duck out of the building. He had to leave the sermon. I know, trash. trash. But they follow Califano to a press club. He too ducked out of the back. And they're just like, we're on you, bitch. We're going to find you. Like, you can't do this forever.
We're not going to let you fucking just live your life.
Yeah. All the way from California. Like, you're going to do this.
Yeah.
You're going to do this. So due to bad press, not because he's doing the right thing, but due to bad press, Califano finally relented. And he signed the regulations on April 28th, 1977. Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. So under 504, non-discrimination became a legal fundamental right within months. Like, so quickly things changed.
Yeah.
Sit-ins, like, this fucking worked, and it worked really fast. They saw pretty quickly in university classrooms started to become accessible, workplaces, public spaces like libraries, like courtrooms, public transit started to make accommodations for people using wheelchairs and other people living with disabilities. Cities instituted curb cuts because that was not a thing that was found outside of there were some in San Francisco, but like, it's something that we all take for granted, and we all benefit from the fact that the curb slopes and there's not just like these, you know, we're not jumping off curbs.
Oh, you don't have to step up. I see.
Yeah. Okay. That started to be a mandate in public spaces. Yeah. Federal buildings started to make adjustments to become more accessible to all, including ramps, wider restroom stalls, of course. The regulations that were instituted as a result of this passage of the 504, it ushered in a new era of accessibility, and it led to the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act of 1990. And I'm just going to end by talking a little bit about the occupiers and like how their lives were changed as a result of this event that was so formative for these young people. Many occupiers had never met people, as I mentioned, with disabilities, and they really bonded over this common sense of purpose. Like, they were doing the right thing. And it was so obvious because, like, duh. So one woman, because there's a documentary about this, I'm going to put it in the show notes. One woman who was filmed during the occupation, she said that, I used to know what I would wish for. I wanted to be beautiful. I wanted to stop being a cripple. But now I know that I'm beautiful. And summing it up later, another person in this documentary said that it didn't matter if you were mentally retarded, blind, or deaf. Everyone felt, we are beautiful. We are powerful. We are strong. We are important. And yeah, big facts. And they did that shit. And they changed the world for all of us. I think a lot of people think that when things are accessible, it's like, oh, it's just for people who are living with disabilities. No, we all benefit from this shit. And even if we didn't, like, it's still the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, the end.
That was amazing. Thank you for telling that.
I feel like it could have been more fun, but like, it's such a good story.
No, it's great. It's amazing. And you said that it wasn't scandalous. That was very scandalous, that the fucking... That they would pass this law and just be like, we don't actually have to make it happen. We already did what we needed
to
do.
It's so incredibly offensive that they really thought that they could write down some words and that would be it. In my head, don't even do anything. If you're not going to do it, like, don't do it. Like,
literally,
why even write it?
What was the point of getting it passed if you weren't going to do anything?
It doesn't make any sense. It's like, it was so infuriating to like read, just research this story and be like, but they're not asking for anything other than for what you already agreed to be real. Like,
ridiculous. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Wild. Well, no, thank you. That was really, I'm so glad that I know that. That was such a great story. Definitely a positive story for once in a while.
Yeah, right? I think that's why I didn't think it was scandalous, because I'm like, wait, something positive happened that made our country better.
Yeah,
which is sadly scandalous. Like, oh my god,
right? Yeah.
People working together, pushing for change. But yeah, I feel like this story should be like screamed from the mountaintops that we can make change if we work together,
right?
Yeah. And we let women lead.
Well, and that's the scandal part of it, is that like, it wasn't the government that made things better.
Nope. Nope.
They were dragging their feet and didn't want to do anything.
Didn't want to do
and
shit.
They had to be forced to make things better.
Yeah.
Trash.
By a coalition led by women.
Yeah.
Led by queer women.
Yeah.
In partnership with everyone else.
Yeah.
Who was down with the struggle. Yeah.
Every other marginalized community anyways. Yeah. Incredible. Well, my drink has done been empty. I feel like people probably heard my ice cubes clinking like 20 minutes ago.
my drink is now empty. Oh, yeah. So good. This drink
it's
is
so tasty.
Good.
Yeah, it's entirely too drinkable.
Damn.
America's history is juicy. We just add gin and lemon juice and sody.
Sody water. Oh my God. My coworker, I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, go ahead. Yeah.
But on Thursday we had a team meeting. My boss is from Staten Island. I can say this because she's listened to a few episodes, but she stopped listening like 2 years ago, which is amazing. but she's so Staten Island, and I find it so delicious when she like allows herself to like slip back into like just how she talks. She was talking about quarawatas. Do you remember? Ooh. Yeah, exactly. Do you remember those like barrels from like barrels of like colored juice?
Oh yeah, what were they called? Like hugs? I think they were.
Yes,
called?
Hugs. But like in New York. Because they were a quarter, they called them quarawatas.
Oh. Amazing.
Right?
Quarawatas.
Like, quarawatas. I'm like,
incredible.
And I giggled, and she's like, oh, my accent slipped out. I'm like, yes.
Quarawatas.
I love it.
Yeah, I always just knew them as hugs.
Yeah, I also knew them as hugs. And I thought, and I didn't mention this in our call because it just seemed... Because I'm the only person on my team who's not from New York or New Jersey. And they always, like, delight in the things I, like, I don't know. And, like, the fact that I call tennis shoes instead of sneakers. Like, there's just so many things. So I didn't want to expose myself. But, yeah, I also call them hugs.
Okay. I mean, I'm from upstate New York. But
upstate
it's not
New York
as
is basically the Midwest.
It totally is.
It truly is,
the
Midwest. Yeah. Like, there's so many. There's so much overlap. But, yeah, I couldn't tell them hugs because they would. Everyone else was like, yeah, quarawatas. And I'm like, yes, totally.
Everyone knows what that is.
Yeah.
Amazing, amazing, amazing. Well, yeah, we didn't add any quarawatas, just sody.
Sody.
but yeah, thank you guys so much for listening to Beyond Reproach. This has been Tux Lerzel.
And Stephanie Domingo.
And thank you to our audio editor, Dev. We could not do this without him.
Facts are facts, America.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Beyond Reproach. Please note that we are not historians. We're just a couple of drunks who never shut up and love history. A full list of all source information can be found in the show notes on our website. Please take a moment to rate, review, and subscribe. Written reviews are especially important. If you like us, please do one of two things. Leave us a written review on Apple Podcasts or send this episode to a friend, family member, or someone who you think would be into it. Don't forget to follow us on social media and make sure you follow us on Instagram because we post our cocktail recipes the Thursday before each full episode. Please drink along with us if you are not driving. We also have a shop on beyondreproachpod.com. Get your merch, brand yourselves. And we also have exclusive content on Patreon where you can directly support the production of our show.